Fred, I'm just going to talk to you about the history of the Oregon Green, and try to make this as brief as possible. A long history, and I'm trying to condense it into something that makes sense but doesn't take too long. We go back to April 1932, and as a result mainly of the efforts of Madison civic leaders like Michael Olbrich here, who had been purchasing parkland to protect it since the mid-1920s. The University of Wisconsin Board of Regents agreed to accept the deeds to these six parcels of land on the southern and western shore of Lake Wingrum and to fund an outdoor facility here. At Olbrich's urging, the board agreed that the facility would not be a park. They also agreed in 1932 that the name of the new facility would be the University of Wisconsin Arboretum Wildlife Refuge and Experimental Forest Preserve. That was the language chosen to describe this place. And therein, folks, lay the root of the challenge that would both energize and vex those who shaped the history of this arboretum right up to the 1960s and beyond. It was an identity question. Quite frankly, can you be all three? An arboretum and a wildlife refuge and an experimental forest preserve? For an answer, this morning I want to briefly follow the history a bit more and work through these three labels. Now, the early shapers of the arboretum tried to follow up and build on that threefold designation. They wanted an arboretum, of course, which for them would be a collection of native plant communities. By having a wildlife refuge here, they meant a small piece of wilderness, specifically a migratory game bird refuge or sanctuary. To be an experimental forest preserve, they needed, well, more trees. And so, in early 1933, even before there was any management on the grounds, the first major reforestation project went into effect. It would produce trees. Sometime in May into June 1933, over 29,000 plant seedlings were purchased by the Arboretum Committee, and the planting started in the southeast corner of the Arboretum under the supervision of a young UW graduate student named Bill, whose full name was G. William Longenecker. You can see down where the seedlings went, the Pine Forest area, down on the right, it's that way. It's now designated, of course, as the Leopold Pines, a memorial to all the Leopold. Now, this was May into June 1933. By October 1933, 4 months later, that graduate student, Bill Longenecker, now a faculty member, would be named executive director of the Arboretum. He would be in charge of Arboretum landscaping and Arboretum planting because he was a horticulturalist. He would eventually put in all the beautiful lilacs and flowering trees over there in the garden that now bears his name. It's the Longenecker Gardens. It's on the grassy area. You can see where the visitor center is. That's where we are right now. Longenecker Gardens. It's to the north. It's the grassy area just north of the parking lot. Now, Longenecker would address primarily the special concerns and challenges of this arboretum as a collection of plant communities rather than a collection of isolated trees and shrubs. He would also manage the place as an experimental forest preserve. Longenecker would oversee the planting of just about everything that went into the ground in the arboretum up to about 1950. But through the 50s, most of the responsibility for arboretum planting, aside from what went into Longenecker's garden, was taken over by Professor John Curtis, for whom the prairie out there is named, the Curtis Prairie. So here we have Longenecker, you see, and eventually Curtis, working on the arboretum plant communities and arboretum forests. But that left one area, one great big challenge open. The facility as a wildlife refuge, a wilderness, a piece of wilderness, as a migratory game bird refuge or sanctuary. And who was appointed to take up that challenge? In June 1933, Aldo Leopold was hired. He was hired as the first ever professor of game management, and he would serve in the Arboretum as the first ever director of research. But he was game management and research. That was his focus. Leopold would immerse himself here in research, particularly research on migratory game birds and on the creation of habitat designed to attract them. And this was where Leopold did most of his arboretum work, the Gardner Marsh on the eastern edge of the arboretum. Leopold and his students worked here with game birds, creating habitat, providing food, building landing areas for migratory birds, putting in feeding stations, etc. One of Leopold's charges from the university when he was hired as the professor of game management was to teach game cropping to Wisconsin farmers to show them how to attract game birds to their farms so they could make additional money by opening the farm and charging hunters. It was the Depression, you know, this was extra income. And Leopold took up the challenge happily. But the teaching of game cropping for Leopold was also a way, as Kurt Meine points out in his biography of Leopold, was a way to teach farmers a new attitude toward the land, and it therefore tied directly into Leopold's thoughts on the land ethic. Now this takes us to 1934 and to talk of putting in a restoring a prairie around here. Actually, the idea was in the air among our supporters as early as 1932, including Longenecker, who at one point spoke of putting a prairie in the center of the arboretum as a coordinating unit. Leopold also was interested in prairie restoration, or really, I think more to the point, land renewal, but to a large extent, I think, because he wanted to create habitat. He wanted to create habitat for game, for hunting. You know, he was game management. That was his job. Yet he also really did want to recreate, as he noted in his speech at the Arboretum dedication in 1934, a sample of what Dane County looked like when our ancestors arrived here during the 1840s. I mean, there were a lot of people connected with the Arboretum at that time who shared in the desire to renew the land. It was part of a nostalgic restoration vision. You know, let's try to restore the land. Let's go back to what we once had. It was also, folks, a response to the Dust Bowl. So in 1934, the Arboretum Committee decided to try to restore a prairie. If successful, it would be the first restored tallgrass prairie in the nation, perhaps in the world. Now, the idea for putting in a tallgrass prairie was shared by most members of the Arboretum Committee, including Norman Fassett here, professor of botany, who was the first to experiment here with prairie transplanting as early as spring 1935. Fassett worked with his graduate students transplanting prairie plants in experimental plots to see how they grow. And actually, as early as April 1934, 2 full months before the dedication, the Arboretum Committee had been out looking for a prairie ecologist to hire. Prairie specialists were very, very hard to find in the early 1930s. And it was Leopold who found one. His name was Ted Sperry. In 1935, he had just finished his PhD at the University of Illinois working with Arthur Vestal. His dissertation was on prairie roots. He was exactly what the Arboretum Committee was looking for. In February 1936, it took over a year to get him here. It's another story, but we don't have time to go into that. Ted Sperry became the first ever Arboretum Prairie Ecologist, but he was paid as a technical foreman by the National Park Service, because in August 1935, the CCC had moved in here, and the Park Service supervised all the field work that was done around here. And at that point, the Arboretum was called Camp Madison. It was the home of the 2670th Company of the CCC. They were billeted it here. And here he is, Ted Sperry, supervising CCC enrollees who are transplanting prairie plants. You see that flatbed truck in the back that they brought him in on. In spring 1936, Sperry began work on the Arboretum Prairie. It was just an old worn-out field, but that's where the Arboretum Committee wanted the prairie. Leopold, as Arboretum Research Director, was Sperry's boss because the prairie effort was considered research. And Leopold told him literally, and we have Sperry's word on this, Leopold told him, go make a prairie. But Sperry was on his own making that prairie. And the reason? Because no one, according to Sperry, knew exactly how to restore a prairie in 1936. Not Leopold, not Fassett, not Longenecker. Sperry was on his own, and that's how he worked, on his own for 5 years with the CCC from 1936 to 1941. But the effort was well worth it. The result eventually would be the Curtis Prairie out there, right now sporting its beautiful autumn colors with blue stem grass, it's 7 feet tall. By the end of 1940, the Arboretum would have two prairies to restore. The second one came along with the acquisition of a 200-acre tract of land that is south of the Beltline called the Grady Tract. The Grady Tract was purchased in December 1940, almost immediately an effort to restore an oak hickory community in the southwest Grady Tract began. It would take years, slowed by particularly a destructive fire in 1954. In 1943-44, Henry Green, university botanist, would begin transforming the low-lying southeast end of the Grady Tract into a prairie that eventually would be named after him. Green was interesting. He was a piece of work. He was really rather eccentric. In 1944, he asked for and received a written precondition from Longenecker and Leopold that only he and a few trusted associates would be permitted to work on his prairie. And so, for the entire duration of the project, up to about mid-1950s, actually, no one else was permitted to plant, experiment, or manipulate that small plot of land. One of the reasons Green insisted on the odd terms was because he didn't want unskilled laborers working haphazardly on his project. By 1951, Green had planted by hand over 12,000 seedlings and mature plants representing at least 133 species. He kept his own records, and they were accurate to the smallest detail. And so you see that by the 1950s, as an arboretum, a collection of plant communities, this place was thriving. And the forestry research program was getting along fairly well in spite of fire damage. But as a wildlife refuge, Leopold's and the profs, the professors from the Ag College, their hope for the 1930s, in the 1930s, the hope never got beyond the late 1940s and then seemed to fade away in the 1950s. I mean, in 1942, there were 400 pheasants here. They had pheasant roundups with the CCC as beaters. As late as 1944, Leopold and Robert McCabe, the arboretum biologist, Leopold's assistant, set up in the arboretum a live mink trapping project, live minks, and they caught 17. The minks were here, and there were that many. There were more. There were also weasels and badgers here. But by the late 1940s, the hope for a wildlife refuge here started to fade. Why? Because the game management program was failing. In 1941, the war started. The CCC left in November 1941. There was no labor and little security available. No one was patrolling the grounds. By 1942, neighborhood dogs and cats were roaming freely. Bird trapping had to be suspended. The animals were killing the birds in the traps. By 1944, it was clear that the Beltline Highway was coming, and there would be a loss of land and storm runoff problems. By 1946, Madison's population was nearing 100,000 and climbing. Madison, the city, was encroaching. Eventually, the game birds stopped migrating through here. By 1946, Leopold and McCabe had shifted most of their wildlife management research to the Fayetteville Grove area near Lake Mills, Wisconsin. In 1948, of course, there was Leopold's untimely death. But there was another major reason why the hope for a wildlife refuge faded into the 50s. You can't have a wildlife refuge without money to support it. For 18 years, from 1932 to 1950, The Arboretum staff had clung to the hope of federal money, federal funding for a refuge. It never came. It was an ongoing failed hope for government funding, funding that was never realized. There was limited additional state money, but never any federal money to speak of, or Forest Service, or Park Service assistance. So if you can't have a wildlife refuge, and even an adequately funded working experimental forest preserve, what do you do? Well, not surprisingly, Arboretum focus started to shift into the 1960s and 70s, and this focus shifted to outreach and education. As early as 1957, the Dane County schools began tours of the Arboretum with busy Arboretum staff members who were often too busy to guide. There was nothing like that in the 30s and the 40s, no tours. And the 60s, well, they were the 60s, increasing concern with environmental issues. By 1962, of course, you know, the time of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the Friends of the Arboretum, the FOA, was formed to public for public outreach mainly. The object was to better connect with the public now, to increase public awareness of environmental concerns and to encourage funding. By the late 1960s, there were more guided tours being offered to the public. By 1970, the new Arboretum Managing Director, Roger Anderson, was quoted saying, "We must reach people, starting with grade school. Our greatest hope lies with young people. I like to teach," he told a reporter. Anderson was a botany professor. By 1971, a volunteer outdoor education program was in place. The late 70s and 80s, there was increased interest in teaching and in promoting a historically defining vision around here called Restoration Ecology, where the Center for It, the journal Ecological Restoration, is published from here. Into the 80s and 90s, the focus on outdoor education increased with even more guided tours and classes. Into the 90s, we begin to see the creation of an environmental education program geared to families called Earth Partnership for Families. There was also the creation of an outdoor education program for education educators and teachers called Earth Partnership for Schools. As time passes, we're sponsoring more institutes and lectures. We offer Earth-focused day camps for kids for the summer. You see more displays here for the public. We sponsor Arboretum Native Plant Garden tours, annual native plant sales, spring and fall trolley tours. There are three this afternoon. The trolley tours are offered in October and May. Also in the 80s and 90s, there was a shift toward increased ecological management and restoration research. Coinciding with that increased effort, during the 80s and 90s, was an increase in the use of work parties and volunteers for outdoor maintenance. One thing is definitely true here, folks, and it doesn't take Sherlock to figure it out, and that is that in recent years, right up to the present, because of limited funding, the Arboretum has become increasingly more and more dependent on the help and expertise of public volunteers. And I don't think we're alone among Arboretum or botanical gardens worldwide.